Good morning and welcome to Listen Local, the bi-weekly webcast from your neighborhood news source, Mission Local. I'm Laura Wenis and I'm back on the housing beat today. My guest is Peter Cohen, who works with an organization called the Council of Community Housing Organizations, nicknamed Choo Choo because of the acronym, and that's pretty much the only way you can pronounce it. Peter, thanks for coming in today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Laura.
So I wanted to give people a sense of what Choo Choo does. Generally, you work with affordable housing, and I think that's what people's sense is. But maybe you could give us a little bit of just a taste of what you have been working on most recently.
Sure. Well, let me try to give a little quick history, because Choo Choo's been around for longer than most of us who are currently active in housing advocacy. In the post-redevelopment urban renewal era of the 60s and 70s, when there was the early efforts at an organizing level with tenant activists and housing activists to actually create local institutions that would do community-based housing work. There was money available at the time to create organizations, including like Mission Housing Development Corporation and others. And in that formation era of the 70s and into the 80s, Choo Choo was founded as a way to both support that institutional development and also create a unified kind of voice and political advocacy for all those community-based organizations. So this is how now we've kind of come to take for granted, if you will, the way affordable housing is done is through community-based nonprofits. But that didn't start at the beginning of time. That was a creation, and Choo Choo was part of that history. There's a really good, for folks who want to read about it, a very, very excellent publication put out by a woman named Marsha Rosen in 2012. She was for a long time at the Mayor's Office of Housing and Redevelopment, and herself an activist with the National Housing Law Project. And she wrote essentially the history of the affordable housing industry and movement in San Francisco, starting in that kind of mid-60s all the way through about 2012-13. So we're sort of picking up on that same legacy. I think the interesting evolution for Choo Choo and also affordable housing is how it's sort of matured. Now we have organizations that are very big and very professionalized development corporations, but they still have those community roots. And so, you know, the goal back then and the goal still is to have affordable housing as a sector that produces stuff, you know, housing units, but also as part of a movement. So it's both an affordable housing industry and it's affordable housing movement. And Choo Choo still does that today.
So when you talk about community roots, I'm interested in diving a little bit more into what exactly that means. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people who work in housing construction or, you know, development, planning, architecture, a lot of those people do feel that they have very strong roots right. in the community because of their own history or having grown up here, what causes they're active in. Right. And what is it that makes a nonprofit development corporation rooted in a community in the way that you're talking about?
Well, their official, most of the organizations, like for example, Mission Housing or Mission Economic Development Agency, META, or TNDC in the Tenderloin, or CCDC in Chinatown, or SFHDC in the Bayview. I mean, there's several of these organizations, TODCO in South of Market. They were officially community development corporations. That was their official term, CDCs. And it wasn't accidental that they were called that, because the goal was not just brick and mortar affordable housing development, but they are really there as institutions that were community-based, that were investing in building those communities in a more holistic way. You've got to also start to step back in time and understand that neighborhoods in San Francisco, unlike neighborhoods across the country, up until very recently, were places that were left behind. You know, these were not the kind of hotspot gentrification neighborhoods, and we can talk about that in a minute, about what's changed today. But for the long period of time from the beginning of this kind of affordable housing movement, these were neighborhoods that had been left behind, disinvested, and then were under attack by things like urban renewal and modern day redevelopment. So those community institutions were building community power as well as building affordable housing, and they were working on economic development around jobs, and they were trying to pull investments into basic things like transportation and streetscape improvements and public safety that otherwise weren't going to happen because they've been effectively abandoned. And so that was very much why these community development corporations were community-based and had a role beyond just building housing.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, too, that many of them bear the names of the neighborhoods that they work in, and that there's a very strong... I mean, San Francisco, I think, as a whole, every neighborhood in San Francisco has a strong neighborhood identity. I work at a newspaper that is focused on solely one neighborhood, so certainly I understand that. But it is interesting that even in housing development, we have neighborhood-based groups because these neighborhoods have such distinct communities. And I'm wondering if you see differences in how these organizations work in different neighborhoods. Is there a difference in how the Tenderloin, how housing can and should be developed in the Tenderloin versus in SoMa versus in the Mission or Chinatown?
Well, it's a good question because at the level of building something, these are generally the same. Like, as I said, the industry has become very professionalized, very skilled, you know, and the practitioners in an affordable housing development organization could go back and forth between the private sector and nonprofit sector. And these days they do.
Right.
So that's where there's a potential of kind of losing that context of community building and just being a housing developer.
Right.
So at that level,
just build the structure.
That level, you know, where it happens is kind of somewhat the same. But the context of what's happening within that community? What are the issues on the ground? Who are the particular people who need to have housing? Are we talking about a neighborhood where there's a real need for family housing? Is it a neighborhood with a lot of seniors? Is it a monolingual population that's primarily non-English speaking? You know, is there a great need for job connection? You know, these are context-based realities that make each individual project fit to its neighborhood context. And even when you have, we have 25 member organizations. That's how Choo Choo's built. It's a coalition of member organizations. And about maybe a third or half of them are actually builders. And even if it's an organization like Mercy Housing, which is one of our member organizations, which isn't based in a particular community, they're not just sort of flying in and punching out, you know, kind of a vanilla project in a neighborhood. They still treat that project in the context of the community as though they were actually that neighborhood kind of based organization. So yeah, there's some similarities, but there's a very genuine attempt to fit the development to the context of the social and economic and even political context of that neighborhood.
Are there any neighborhoods in the city that could benefit from a neighborhood specific development corporation that don't have one?
Absolutely. And what you've seen over that period of time is a shrinkage of organizations that are able to do housing development because it's become so much more difficult just at a technical and professional level. The scale that now is necessary to kind of make the numbers work and to justify in many respects the level of investment means those projects have to be very, very big. The smallest project really realistically that can get funded these days is 50, 60, 70 units.
Wow.
And now we're talking about projects coming in regularly at 100 or more. So these are huge developments. It used to be in the old days, it was, you know, 4 units, 10 units, 20 units. So
huge speaking in San Francisco terms.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you're outside San Francisco, that's considered like a behemoth, right? I mean, where else do you build other than like LA?
Or New York.
No, but I mean in California, right? Yeah,
sure.
New York, of course. Yeah, New York, that would, I guess, be a mid-sized project. But in California, you know,
that's pretty big.
That's why people in the suburbs get freaked out when we talk about San Francisco.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is in the scale of affordable housing, it requires now big money, big projects, big skill.
Yeah, go big or go home.
Yeah, go big or go home. And unfortunately, and I think this is a tension, that has thinned out the organizations that can do that work. And so what we're left with is fewer community-based organizations, and the ones that have survived, so to speak, have had to get big enough to deal with this. And so we're missing, for example, there used to be a Haight-Ashbury neighborhood kind of affordable housing organization. So that's not there. We don't have a Western Addition-based affordable housing or community development corporation. We don't have an Upper Market Castro affordable housing development corporation.
Is there one in the Bayview?
There's one in the Bayview, which is San Francisco Housing Development Corporation.
Uh-huh.
And they're relatively new, I think maybe about 15 years. So they anchor that. We don't have a dedicated affordable housing organization in the Excelsior. Now, Bernal Heights Neighborhood Corporation has had a long history. It's not doing as much development now, and used to kind of, if you will, cover the Excelsior. So we've got some spots, if you will, if you're really taking it at a community level, where in an ideal world, we'd have a community-based organization The reality is it's extremely difficult to start a new organization today. Whether you're a nonprofit doing, organic food or affordable housing, it's difficult. So how we've done this is having our existing organizations stretch out beyond the neighborhoods, their core neighborhoods, and work in those places. And that's been delicate because they've needed to and wanted to partner with local organizing groups to make sure that, again, if like a CCDC from Chinatown is doing a development project in the Excelsior or in the Southeast, that they're not just sort of seen as flying in as an out-of-neighborhood. They're working with some local organization. We see those partnerships increasingly as we try to reach those other neighborhoods.
So I want to ask what your role is in all this. We've talked a little bit now at the higher level of like interaction between the groups and the history of the groups. Mm-hmm. But I think I'd like to know a little bit more about what you do on the daily,
right,
and how you got into this work.
Right. So at a kind of level of, a coalition that supports the affordable housing developers in San Francisco, there's just a variety of care and feeding kind of things that, and my partner, Fernando Martí, he and I are the co-directors. We're just a three-person staff for Choo Choo itself, for the coalition. So there's a lot of things we do to kind of troubleshoot at a programmatic level, things that come up with the Mayor's Office of Housing. I mean, we're always coming up with our bright ideas for creative new things, and they've got to figure out how to implement them and work together. And then there's always just a constant process of making those program implementation things work. And so somebody's got to be in that kind of space of creating the glue and the soft tissue between the housing providers and the service providers and the city itself. So we do a tremendous amount of that, which most folks don't see and know, right? Things just kind of happen. So that's a huge role for us. We're also involved in policy. So that's, the other part of what might seem a little bit like it just happens is, where does money come from? How do we get our access to sites? How does public policy in and of itself prioritize affordable housing? And when you take it at the level of California and even nationally, San Francisco is an absolute leader in affordable housing, both in terms of the numbers of production, but also in terms of the political culture of having it as a priority. And that didn't, again, just kind of happen. It happened because of Choo Choo's long history and other organizers. And so we continue to be really involved in public policy, working on ballot measures for funding, public sites, and things at legislative level to make sure that we're constantly setting up, again, those policy building blocks and the resources to get bricks and mortar housing on the ground.
Yeah. And because you just brought up policy, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on this sort of, I thought it was a pretty massive sort of block of legislation that was just passed at the state
right.
level about housing, which included some funding, like you talked about,
yeah.
but also included SB 35, which is a little bit more of a controversial piece that a lot of people see as just streamlining the process and making housing production faster and sort of moving aside a lot of the roadblocks that slow things
right.
down, and which other people, from what I understand, see as this somewhat sort of top-down imposition where neighbors will have less of an input on new projects. And I wanted
right.
to get your perspective on sort of that package as a whole. And if you want to talk about SB 35, that
sure.
Could.
Yeah. And let me do this. I mean, I want to step back for a second, then get into that specific question, because
mm-hmm.
again, we started off saying, so what's Choo Choo's history, its role, what's the story and what are you guys doing today? It has that long arc. And I think the key thing is to understand what's different today, and literally in the last 5-10 years, than it has been in many respects for that long history? And why do we have this kind of chaos in some respects? And it can get very volatile and combative with, folks who are all claiming to be housing advocates, right? So why is it happening? It's really interesting because we've been spending some brain space stepping back. Another thing we do is actually try to think, believe me, Laura,
it's a good habit.
things are getting built on the ground and there's, legislative battles at City Hall or on the ballot. But, at some level, it's important to also have just kind of thoughtful analysis of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And when you kind of look at what's happening at a state or at least a regional level, it's just a fascinating kind of perfect storm of things in the last 5-10 years. One of them, obviously, is we have a continuing growth of population in California and continuing workforce development. Everybody's moving west, right? And that's combining with a really radical change in where people want to live. And this is, you know, kind of finally the victory of smart growth. You know, I was on the Greenbelt Alliance board back in the early 2000s, and we were saying, you know, people should live in more compact development, and, you know, still it was
urban living,
single,
density,
single family pancake development and rolling over farm fields. Well, that actually has now shifted dramatically. And it's combined with what's happened post Great Recession in the 2006-7-8 period. There was a complete collapse of the investment market in real estate. And what's happened as in the rebound is there's hardly any development happening in single family housing. I mean, compared to what it was, it's just completely fallen off the map. And where you see the uptick in housing development is primarily urban. And that's aligned with people wanting to live in those kind of urban places. So you see suddenly this this guy named Rick Jacobus, who's a really interesting thinker too, called it a tectonic shift. Like kind of imagining this huge shift of kind of, you know, young and kind of middle income folks desiring to live a more urban lifestyle, you know, and whether that's in San Francisco or whether they want to live in downtown Livermore is, I think, the big question. But that then also conspires with this income inequality, which we've all been reading about, right? So tremendous and growing inequality of income and wealth. And then, you know, you put all that together in these very compact places. You know, like everybody wants to live in some kind of urban lifestyle. There's more people. There's more inequity of wealth. And there's no real options because the suburbs are kind of lying stagnant. And we're in this extremely volatile environment. So I just want to kind of lay that as a context. We're thinking about this is we're not going to solve California or the region's housing needs on the head of a pin in San Francisco. There needs to be kind of a regional look at how do you get those suburbs to build that kind of moderate density housing that we've all been talking about, the YIMBYs and Choo-Choo and Hack and Spur, and everybody agrees on that. The big question is how do you do it? And that gets a bit to your housing package. So at a very nuts and bolts level, the two, I guess, kind of, you know, straightforward bills that are going to help affordable housing are the SB2, SB3. These were funding bills. At San Francisco scale, SB2, the estimates are between 5 and 10 million a year. So it's very, very, I mean, that's about
not
a third of a project.
Yeah.
Literally. I mean, it takes about 20 to 30 million bucks to get a project off the ground. Oof. So, sure, it's a nice little, you know, shot in the arm, but we're going to need a big local revenue measure, and we're talking about that for the next year or two. So there's one, but it's good at the state level. The second is SB3. It's a statewide affordable housing bond, which is going to be a very important campaign for November. And we're going to be working on that here in San Francisco. We need to get a huge bunch of votes and hopefully changing the culture of affordable housing support across the state. I know that's what the big game plan is. So those are two good things, resources. We've always taken the position that we can't rely on the state and the feds to be the lion's share of funding. We got to have the lion's share of funding locally. And that's why San Francisco has, you know, 30,000 or 35,000 affordable housing units compared to many other cities, because we've primarily locally funded that. Then other bills in the package that I think are important to note is the long overdue so-called Palmer fix. This was what kind of unlocked the inability of cities to apply inclusionary housing policy at a local level for private development. And that's been something trying to get through the legislature for 6 years. Mark Leno had proposed it back in 2011, and it finally was passed this year in a different bill form. And you've quickly saw the city of San Jose and a number of other cities putting in place new inclusionary housing policies that they couldn't do before. So that's really good. You would ask about SB 35, and it's really interesting. You know, we got, you know, kind of all kinds of fingers pointed at us somehow being against SB 35. And it's really important to clarify, nobody disagreed with it for affordable housing. Nobody. And I'd love for someone to say who would.
For anybody who isn't, you know, into this, SB 35 was the streamlining bill, which tries to remove certain procedural hurdles that projects have to pass and that also neighbors and organizations can sort of throw up to try to give their input for a project. But it makes a distinction between affordable housing and market rate housing. And so whatever the city is not meeting its state set goals on production of, that's what the hurdles are moved aside for.
Right. Exactly. And so I think for affordable housing, I mean, for San Francisco, you know, I think SB 35 application to affordable housing projects going to have a marginal difference because, again, our struggles here are around money and land.
Although, that's, I mean, I have seen affordable housing get held up by discretionary reviews and appeals. And that's the kind of thing that will no longer be possible until the city meets its goals on production for that.
Yeah, no city will ever meet its goals on affordable housing. Let's be realistic about Laura. I mean, you know, this is the structural problem of our, you know, housing is a private commodity for the most part. So we're working against that kind of tide. So yeah, affordable housing will always permanently benefit from the streamlining under SB 35. And as I said, yeah, you're going to have some marginal benefit, and I think it's a good marginal benefit in San Francisco. But where you're going to see the big benefit, I think, is in jurisdictions where affordable housing is so opposed that kind of streamlining will have a much more demonstrable value of moving projects through. And I used to work at East Bay Housing Organizations, and I know the East Bay and other places. And it is a world of difference trying to do a project in, say, Livermore or Pleasanton or Concord than it is in San Francisco. So I know we look at San Francisco, and we think this is like it is everywhere. And a marginal benefit is a good thing. You know, take away the discretionary review appeal and other things going to shave off not only time but headaches, because you know that's a big part of what our folks have to do is deal with headaches. But I think you're going to start seeing that benefit of being able to get affordable housing moving in other parts of the state where it's basically been, you know, effectively dead.
Especially when you're talking about, you know, the economies of scale and how you have to make things big projects. And one of the most common objections to any housing project is it's too big or it doesn't fit in. And when you can't raise that objection in the same way, that might happen faster.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, you know, working in the East Bay suburbs. I'm sure it's like this in the San Mateo suburbs and elsewhere. Is, you know, all the sort of reasons that people have for not wanting to support affordable housing, you know, and they'll come at it from traffic. And, oh, it turns out that it's actually very low parking and very low auto usage. And they'll come at it from, you know, a design and scale thing. It turns out that affordable housing typically uses the best architects in the state and has to go through much, much higher standard of design because everybody's watching it, you know, so there's very high levels of design. You'll see it's hilarious, you know, like marketing brochures for a community will often use an affordable housing project to, you know, kind of sell a place because they're so attractive because they've had such high quality design. And you can just kind of get very generic market rate housing development. So there's an irony about the, you know, opposition because of height and design. But, you know, often it comes down to that folks have all kinds of perceptions about who's going to live in it and how it's going to be managed. And, you know, we just experienced this recently. We had to put a fair amount of energy behind this supportive housing project in Mission Bay that just went through it's the former Redevelopment Commission. They call them now OCII, whatever. But it just went through a hearing last week, and it's had a couple community meetings. And there's a fair amount of organizing by the neighborhood to oppose this project. And it's going to sail through. I don't have any doubt about that. And we organized for the hearing. But folks have all kinds of ideas why they don't want to support something like this. And I think a big part of it, Laura, we've experienced is that most people aren't familiar with what an affordable housing project is. They just don't know. And, you know, so ignorance can lead to all kinds of perceptions. And a big part of it gets back to the community-based thing. A big part of what good affordable housing developers do is they win over hearts and minds because they work in the communities where they do their projects.
And they don't just stick people into a building. They are around and they do management and they provide services and things like that as well.
Absolutely. They're there to stay, and so they have a reputation on the line. But also, they end up getting to know the neighbors. They educate them. They allay their fears and perceptions by basically helping them to understand what the real thing is that's going to be happening as opposed to reacting to something that they've just heard about. And it actually works. Generally speaking, at the end of a project cycle, more people are supportive than are opposed. So I think SB 35 will have a good effect for affordable housing in many locations. You know, the controversy over the market rate housing, you know, is a whole different story. But I think as an affordable housing advocate, streamlining is a good thing.
All right, Peter, we're running out of time here, but I really appreciate that you came in today and talked with me about this.
Oh, thanks for having me, Laura. Anytime.
We'll be back 2 weeks from today with news and narratives from the neighborhood. If you'd like to get in touch, shoot us an email. We're at info@missionlocal.com. We're also on Twitter, where we're at MLNow. And up next, it's Back to the Music. Keep it here on BFF.FM. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.